This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Very good afternoon to you. 12:05. And after 12:30 today, a little bit about what the horticulture industry is doing, taking the lead really on trying to crack down on those poor and illegal working conditions in the industry, in the fruit and veggie sector. They've come up with a program. It's called Fair Farms. It's been on trial for the last, 18 months or so. And it's all about giving the industry a clear direction on how to do the right thing in this area. And also you, the shopper, the confidence to go and buy your fruit and vegetables, knowing that it's coming from an ethical farm. More about that later in the hour. And shortly, just checking in on a couple of spots on the map in the grain-growing area of Western Australia, heading to the north of that region and just checking on the rain that's been falling in the last, not quite a week or so, and what difference that's made to the season. And then heading all the way south just to check in there, because there are still a few spots that haven't had as much as some of the other parts of the grain belt. So just getting a sense of what's going on in the region. You can tell me your story too. 0448 922 604 to be part of the conversation this afternoon. We'll kick off our travels today in Derby in the Kimberley, where the state's largest fish farm is recovering from an algal bloom that wiped out almost 20% of its barramundi stock. Singapore-owned Marine Produce Australia says the bloom occurred in mid-February and it killed around 220,000 fish at its Cone Bay site. This is where the fish are grown out in large ocean cages. Chief Executive Andres Johnson says the algae is not toxic for humans and there are no ongoing health issues for the fish that have survived.
We used to deal with that kind of problems, which is an algae bloom, which is a natural product that is something impossible to prevent or to predict. So it's just coming out from some specific weather conditions, especially when it is really, really warm and the intensity of the light is also very strong. So we have got an algae bloom there. And then we have suffered a little bit. In some cages, we have got some mortalities and we lost 18-20% of our total biomass, which means something like 200,000 fish.
Have you had any information from the previous owners or the local staff about whether it's happened before on that scale?
Not too much, because as I said earlier, I mean, there's not too many research and studies around the Kimberleys in terms of, historical data. But I understood that we got smaller algae blooms, but it seems that it's something which is happening. And I would say in some way it is normal according to my experience, because of course it is much higher probabilities to get one when the temperature of the water is 30, 32 degrees.
Have you made any changes at the farm to try to better monitor or respond?
We have changed. We already put in place a regular water monitoring. And of course, we are also talking with some institution which is called DHI in Perth, because they have some information and some works in satellite imagery. So we are talking with those people.
Marine Produce Australia's Andres Johnson with Erin Park. It's talking about that new and enhanced monitoring systems that have been put in place just to try and detect those algal blooms ahead of time. You may remember a majority share of Cone Bay was sold to Singapore's largest fish farm company last July. And Barramundi Asia has told customers there will be lower barramundi supplies for the next few months, with up to $5 million worth of stock lost in that particular fish kill. ABC WA, 10 past 12. Well, Australia's winter crop will jump 20% this year, according to the National Forecaster. In its first crop report of the year, ABARES today tipped this year's winter crop to reach 36.4 million tonnes. And the national wheat crop is forecast to be 21.2 million tonnes. Senior economist with ABARES, Peter Collins, says the big increase in the national crop comes off a low base.
Now, that 20% might seem a lot, but a lot of last year's crop was damaged and cut for hay in places like Victoria and South Australia and southern New South Wales. And so you've got to put that in perspective, that 20% increase. And in fact, the national total, that forecast total, is still around 10% below the 10-year average. Now, it's been a bit of a mixed picture across the cropping zone. There was good May rainfall in South Australia and Victoria and southern New South Wales, but autumn rainfall in a lot of cropping regions in West Australia and northern New South Wales and southern Queensland was below average. And but Western Australia has been pretty fortunate over the last weekend, and a lot of areas that had a good fall, and that might even see some more late sowing in some of those regions.
Even though there will be a bounce back this year, you're still estimating that this year's crop will be about 10% below the 10-year average. What's the reason for that?
The Western Australian crop at this stage, not being as big as it was last year, and there's still significant parts of the eastern states that will struggle to come up to an average crop. New South Wales and southern areas are looking quite good, but the further north you go, the prospects are much less robust. And the same in southern Queensland. And so that's why we're still seeing the national total below the 10-year average.
Yeah, so speaking of Western Australia, according to these figures that you've put out, the wheat crop will be back about 20% in Western Australia. But of course, they came off an absolute bumper last year. What are you seeing for that state?
A lot is going to depend on in-crop rainfall. Because a lot of the regions had below average autumn, we've assumed that rainfall will be average and timely across the cropping zone in WA. And often that's what happens in Western Australia. And so, you know, we think that the area will be down a bit. Production also down a little bit. But like you said, that's because it's coming off a good year last year. In fact, last year was their second highest on record.
ABARES senior economist Peter Collins with Emma Field. And if you want to read more about the crop forecast and the rain across Western Australia, just make your way to the ABC Rural website. In your search engine, just put ABARES, A-B-A-R-E-S, ABARES crop, ABC, and it's the first story that pops up there if you'd like to have a read through. It's 13 past 12. Well, let's have a listen through to some of these very sobering figures, because the USDA's latest world supply and demand estimates have been released overnight. The big news was US corn production was slashed by 9%, which pushed corn futures up. And on the wheat side, the USDA increased the expected global wheat crop by almost a million tonnes, mainly because of a slightly larger crops in the Black Sea. Ukraine farmers are expected to export a record 19.5 million tonnes of wheat this season, while Russia is tipped to export 37 million tonnes. Now, they are really big numbers, especially when you consider Australia exports around 13 to 14 million tonnes a year. And interestingly, the second largest wheat producer, India, had its wheat crop raised by just over a million tonnes to 101 million tonnes. Quite incredible, isn't it, some of those figures? Well, let's have a look around our own backyard and hear from a few farmers, starting in the northern agricultural region. You can definitely say in this part that they have had breaking rain. Some farms near the coast registered over 100 millimetres of rain. Others further inland got less. But, you know, we're still talking about 30 millimetres or so. Ben Royce's family farms merino sheep, cereal crops and legumes at Greneve near the coast. They've had good rain, and he's expecting to see green shoots emerging from the ground in just the next few days.
We've had 80 mil since the rain started, and it just hasn't stopped. It's been beautiful.
What were things like before you've had that rain?
Quite dry. We're optimistic still, but we were waiting out for the break to happen, and now it's here. Everyone's a little bit more relaxed.
I've interrupted you in the paddock today. What are you putting in?
We're putting in some wheat here in the last paddock on the crop on the farm.
And it must be pretty good to be popping it into a paddock that's not dry and dusty, because I saw you seeding not that long ago and there was a big cloud of dust going up.
It is, yeah. It's really nice. The smell, just going to clean dirt that's wet and, you know, not dry and dusty. And, yeah. I think the air cleaner on the tractor's pretty happy about it too.
Yeah, I think there's been a few of them changed this year. from here, you've got most of your crop in, just finishing off today. How long will it be until you think you'll start seeing some crop emerge?
Oh, over the next few days, we'll see a few green shoots coming up from the early crops we put in, which will be really nice. And I think the sheep will be pretty happy as well for the pasture paddock, so they'll all start sprouting soon too.
So we're looking at emergence, what, mid-June. Are you worried about some of the crops, like canola, for example?
Yeah, canola's probably, they like a bit of a longer season. And if the rain does carry through to August, it'll be all right. But if we get cut off a bit earlier, could be a worry.
Did you change your program at all, given how late it was getting?
We did a little bit. We still have oats, wheat, barley and some lupins in the silos, which was all supposed to be in the ground by now. But we've cut it short a bit.
So from here, it's just basically sitting and waiting and seeing what happens, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We'll finish this paddock today or tomorrow, and then we'll sit and wait and watch and hope it keeps coming.
Greenough farmer Ben Royce with Joe Prendergast. 17 past 12. Chris Reichstein farms at Mount Burdett, about 50 kilometres northeast of Esperance. He's happy that the region has got some rain, but he really hopes they get some more.
We've been reasonably fortunate here, Emma. We had rain back in early May. We pick up about 20-odd mils, which enables us to get planting. About 3 weeks later, we pick up another 10 or 12. And so we've managed to get crop out of the ground. So our break was probably a little while ago, but this has certainly cemented it now. We picked up another 10 mils last night. So moisture's good, crops are up and away. But probably for a large percentage of the area, probably north of here as we go up into the Mallee, things have been a lot drier through there, probably through the top end of Cascades and Salmon Gums and through into Beaumont, where they really have been needing this rain. So, look, all in all, it's you could call it the break.
People have said it's a very late time in the season to get the break. Is that your view?
Probably a week or probably a couple of weeks later than what we'd normally like. But as I say, we've had dribs and drabs, which enabled us to get crop in, which has been good. But I think what's really happened is it's been very hard for the people who've got livestock, because we haven't had a decent rain to actually grow pasture at this point. So there's been a lot of hay bored in, a lot of hand feeding of stock.
What are the confidence levels like for farmers in the Esperance District about this year?
I'd say probably fairly reasonable. Look, we've had a run of good years. We've been very fortunate. And now to get this rain, we have got these horrible nor'westerly winds, which generally tends to keep rain away. But if we can actually get rid of the nor'westerlies and then can turn southerly and we get more of a normal winter pattern, I think everyone would be reasonably happy.
What's the season looking like compared to last year?
Very, very different. Last year we had 130 mils of summer rainfall in February, and we started sowing in mid-April, whereas we didn't start sowing until the start of May this year because we didn't have any subsoil moisture at all. So I was pretty reticent to make a start. Last year we had that summer rainfall, we got going in mid-April. Then we had a very long dry period and very poor establishment in crops. But then August was very good for us and we ended up with a well above average year. This year's been quite different. We've only received dribs and drabs of rain. We had no summer rainfall. We've got better crop establishment. However, we don't have so much in reserve later on, but hopefully the season will take care of that with a good winter.
That is Mount Burdett farmer Chris Reichstein with Emma Field just talking about the seasonal conditions. Not everyone got the rain. There was only 5 millimetres for the week at Cascade, and Grass Patch got 12 millimetres, while the drought declared Newdigate and Lake Grace regions have recorded sort of 15 and 18 respectively, I should say. And this through on the text, and you can be part of this conversation too, 0448 922 604. Nick's text through from Condingup, east of Esperance, and just wanted to let you know that In the Esperance region, they've had 15 millimetres overnight. But when you look at individual farms, he had 0.6. And that's what happens when the wind stays in the west and doesn't get around to the southwest. We've had 11 millimetres over the last 5 days, so still pretty dry. Thanks for letting us know about that, Nick. And this through from Phil, 21 millimetres at Gregory Park overnight. 0448 922 604 to be part of the conversation on the Country Hour here this afternoon. And it's 20 past 12. Well, Chris, you just heard from, briefly mentioned that some farmers in the south and southeastern growing regions of Western Australia have been hand-feeding livestock, and some have been carting water as well just to keep up the water to them. And I wonder how much it's cost them, because it's not only livestock owners who have to cart water. Heading over east to southern Queensland, tomato and capsicum grower Tim Carnell has spent close to $1 million carting water to ensure he's got a crop. He told Lydia Burton it was cheaper to cart water to his farms near Stanthorpe than it was to walk away from the crop.
Yeah, so we started carting water, Lydia, on the 28th of November, and we just knocked the trucks off there two Wednesdays back. So it was 176 days after we started. And we had Christmas Day and Boxing Day off, and every other day and night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the one, two, up to three semi-tankers were running at any one time to keep our vegetable operation going. Our family have spent in excess of $800,000 carting water this year. That was to finish off the farms generally. We didn't start carting water for our crops to grow, so it was supplementing them so we could get that extra yield. We have a high value crop with high value customers, and that was what we had to do to get through the season.
Looking back, was it a good decision? Was it worth it?
Oh, it was a worthwhile decision, and I guess the benefit we had was we knew what we were getting at the market when we were carting. So, like I say, we were supplementing the final 20% generally of the crop in a very tough summer year or a very tough summer season. It certainly has cut away a fair bit of the bottom line, and there was, you know, a little bit of reward for the effort we made this year. But that's farming. You know, we pay our staff, we pay our bills, we pay ourselves, and we go around next year.
I was interested in that. You know, that's just one cost in your production system. You know, $800,000 alone just in water, let alone the labour. You know, you had to have someone driving that truck 24 hours a day. I was interested if, you know, your bottom line, if it was worth it financially, if you still made money off that crop.
Yeah, so we grow tomatoes and capsicums. Again, a high potential return per hectare. You know, the numbers for us did stack up. If we work it back, you know, you could work it back to possibly, you know, 20 or 30 cents a kilo. So that's in a, you know, terminology that might be able to be digested a little bit more by the people that aren't familiar with the scale or the speed of the operations here. But yeah, it certainly was a big expense, and that was $800,000 that we'll never see again, and was $800,000 that we can't reinvest into our business next year.
Stanthorpe farmer in southern Queensland, Tim Carnell, who says it's close to 2 years since they had a good rain, and that was Cyclone Debbie back in March 2017. And Tim says the old timers in his area say it's the driest it's ever been. 24 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
And if you're interested in that story about the carting water in southern Queensland and carting water, not for livestock on this occasion, but for the crops, the tomatoes, the capsicums, there is a story online, the ABC Rural online page, if you'd like to check it out and read more about it. News headlines not far away, but some resources news for you now. A small drilling operation might have found one of the world's best and shallowest deposits of cobalt on the WA Northern Territory border. Now, cobalt is used in the production of batteries for cars and battery banks, which are all the rage at the moment. Prodigy Gold and the Independence Group have been drilling near the remote community of Kintore, which is about 500 kilometres west of Alice Springs. And they've just got their first drill results back. And Prodigy's Managing Director, Matt Briggs, says the quality of this cobalt looks world class.
We have up to 2.5% cobalt in outcrop, so sticking out of the ground. And that is very uncommon to see in Australia or all most parts of the world. Really, the only other jurisdiction that I've seen those sort of cobalt results is in the Congo, which is a very high risk, and there's less optimal practices when it comes to mining there. So if we can replace a part of the world's cobalt supply from a new high-grade mine in the Northern Territory, that improves the quality of our batteries and the ethics of their production going forward.
Did you say you're drilling at 63 different spots around that area?
So we've got one rig there, and it started in the southwest of the program, and it's working through 63 targets and drilling them one after the other. So high potential for a major discovery down there, so it's a very exciting time. These are the first drill holes that have ever been done into this project that we're doing at the moment. From our field mapping, it's about 5 kilometres long at surface. So we've done 3 holes so far, and we're looking to potentially do more holes this drilling season once we get those assays back. So those assays should be back in the next few weeks, and then we'll know just how big it is.
Matt Briggs, the Managing Director of Prodigy Gold, with Jack Price, and talking about the Lake Mackay joint venture with the Independence Group. 26 past 12, and we will stick with mining news for a moment longer, because Gina Rinehart has made her first strategic move to expand Atlas Iron since a successful takeover in October last year. Her company, Hancock Prospecting, has applied to the Environmental Protection Agency to develop a new mine at Corunna Downs, just south of Marble Bar in WA's Pilbara region. That project was put on hold a few years ago when iron ore prices slumped. But prices are now at a 5-year high, so global iron ore market analyst Andrew Gadd can see why Gina Rinehart has decided to bring another project online.
Corunna Downs was part of Atlas's portfolio. That was a project that they were planning to bring on as the natural sort of next replacement for the Mount Webber mine, which is currently operating but is expected to deplete shortly in early 2022. So with that depletion, Corunna Downs could ramp up and replace not all of that production, but some of that production. So we have Mount Webber producing around 7 to 8 million tonnes per year, and Corunna Downs would be on the order of 4 to 5 million tonnes per year.
And what does that mean for Hancock Prospecting now they've taken over Atlas?
So market conditions weren't as favourable at the time that Hancock moved ahead with taking over Atlas, and Atlas had at that time shelved the plans for Corunna Downs. But since then, particularly with recent events in Brazil, the market conditions are certainly much more favourable. So it makes sense that Corunna Downs is now, you know, feasible to go ahead.
And I guess looking back at that deal, it was Atlas Iron was quite sought after. You had FMG and Mineral Resources both sort of tussling over Atlas. And then, of course, Gina Rinehart's deal was the one that won out. Why were so many people looking at Atlas Iron favourably? What makes it a prize gem in the portfolio?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess, you know, the availability of resources that are operating or resources that have had the work done so that they're sort of ready to go with favourable market conditions in the Pilbara, you know, are relatively few and far between. So, you know, a lot of the resources are sort of locked up with majors. So Atlas is a, you know, attractive for an acquiring company looking for a smaller asset portfolio that can be brought to market. So that's really where Atlas was fitting in for those sort of buyers.
You mentioned at Corunna Downs, it's expected to produce 5 million tonnes of iron ore a year from that project. I guess, what's the significance of that tonnage out of Corunna of the broader iron ore market in the Pilbara. Is that quite a lot?
Oh, look, it's relatively small in the perspective of the global market. It's sort of, you know, towards 2 billion tonnes. So 5 million tonnes a year is a pretty small proportion of the global market. But it is, you know, it's a contributor to filling that supply gap that has been caused in Brazil, where around 90 million tonnes of capacity has been lost. So bringing 5 million tonnes in from Corunna Downs certainly plays a role in filling that gap.
And presumably with prices up to, you know, five-year highs, it's a good time to be starting up a new iron ore project.
Absolutely. I mean, we do expect those supply disruptions in the southern part of Brazil to persist for a number of years. So that's going to support a higher price trajectory than what we previously forecasted. And also particularly relevant to Corunna Downs, that the discounts for lower grade ores have also narrowed. So really, as the segment of the market, the lower grade ore, iron ore, has performed the best more recently. And Corunna Downs fits into that sort of bracket, the 58% Fe type of ore, very similar to the Mount Weber ore. So it's I guess it fits well for the current market, and I suppose there's not too many other projects like this that could be taken advantage of in these conditions.
Global iron ore market analyst CRU, that's the company he works for, Andrew Gadd with Courtney Fowler. The EPA is after some public comment on whether or not it should assess the proposal to develop Corunna Downs, and submissions close tomorrow, so you can see more details on the EPA's website. And just to finish off our resources coverage today, a major oil and gas project off WA's Kimberley Coast has celebrated an important milestone following the departure of its first LNG shipment to Asia. The cargo left Shell's Prelude floating liquefied natural gas facility yesterday, and that's moored around about 475 kilometres northeast of Broome. And this is one of two new major LNG projects in the Browse Basin, with INPEX's Ichthys also ramping up production last year. And we've popped a few photos and more details on the story on the ABC Rural Facebook page for you to have a read through. 28 to 1. Jonathan Beale in the studio. What's making the headlines, Jonathan?
Thanks, Belinda. In the headlines, Victorian Construction Union leader John Setka says reports he denigrated the work of anti-domestic violence campaigner Rosie Batty have been fabricated for political gain. Labor's executive has suspended his membership of the party over the comments, which were allegedly made at a union meeting last week. Mr. Setka denies the accusations and says he'll stay on in his position. The Premier, Mark McGowan, says his government will continue to negotiate with the Upper House on its legislative agenda following the resignation of One Nation MP Charles Smith. Mr. Smith resigned from the party last night and is now an independent. The government needs the support of the Greens and one other member in the Upper House to pass legislation. And the Police Commissioner, Chris Dawson, says officers will soon have partially automatic body cameras to record incidents when force is used. An officer's body camera and that of other police within 10 metres will turn on automatically when they draw a weapon. Incidents when a weapon is not drawn will require the officer to turn the camera on manually. More news coming up at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Jonathan. 26 to 1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Before the news at 1 o'clock, off to Katanning today for the results of the sheep market, and also talking about how the horticultural industry is really trying to get on top of poor and illegal working conditions in some parts of the industry. Of course, most people are doing the right thing, but there are some elements in that sector, and the industry has come up with a program called Fair Farm. So it's been on trial. They like what they see, and it's going to be officially launched, I think, in a couple of weeks or so. But today, a little sneak peek at what that's all about, getting the industry on the right track, and also for shoppers to know that they're buying fruit and veggies that come from an ethical farm. And also some great innovation in packaging in fruit and veggies, for example, because everyone's so turned off by excessive use of plastics, you know, to wrap bananas and apples and those sort of things. So there's all this innovation going on behind the scenes to try and come up with something else that the fruit and veg can be packed in and also to keep it fresh for a longer period of time. That's to come between now and the news at one. Right now it's off to the Weather Bureau. Matt Bodehoven with you today. Matt, what are the major features on the chart today?
Yeah, good afternoon, Belinda. Well, today we've got a cold front approaching the western south coast. So over the next few days in the outback areas, we won't be seeing a lot of activity, mostly sunny conditions. Might be a hint of a shower around the southern goldfields and the Eucla over the weekend, and better chance near the Eucla coast. But into the southwest land division, for Thursday, we've got a weak cold front that's going to move over the southwest. So we'll see some showers southwest of Aline, Geraldton to Hopetoun, and along the coast, the Esperance coast there. Could see up to 5 millimetres in the rainfall gauge in the lower west, southwest, and south coastal. Maybe 1 to 2 millimetres in the great southern and the southeast coastal districts. On Friday, another cold front will reach the southwest Friday evening. Showers over most parts of the southwest land division, apart from the far northern and eastern parts. Could see up to 8 millimetres around the western south coast, around one millimetre getting into the wheat belt areas of the Great Southern and the Central Wheat Belt, and maybe 3 millimetres around the lower west and the adjacent central west. On Saturday, ridge of high pressure will develop over northern parts of the southwest land division, but we could still see some showers near southwest line Geraldton to northern Chisholite Bay. Though fairly light rainfall figures in it, maybe only 1 or 2 millimetres around the lower west. Could see 5 millimetres near the western south coast, but very light in the inland parts. On Sunday, a weak cold front will brush the western south coast, shower southwest line Dongara to Hopetoun to Islite Bay. And rainfall figures may see another 5 millimetres around the southwest district.
All right, that's as far as we can see, is it, Matt?
That's as far as on the four-day outlook, and if you want to stretch a little bit past the weekend, we'll have a high-pressure system push over the southern parts of the southwest land division, so we'll get a little bit of a break over from the wet weather for most parts there on Monday and Tuesday.
All right, warnings this afternoon?
Yeah, just got a couple of strong wind warnings around the Albany coast and Esperance coast.
All right, thank you for the wrap. Appreciate that. 23 to 1, and Richard Hudson's in the studio now just to go through the rainfall figures, and we're looking back at the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, those that are 5 mils and over. In the Pilbara region, Mount Stewart had 5, and in the Gascoyne region, Tamala 5, and that's it for the northern and eastern forecast districts. But down in the southwest land division, in the central west, Alanuka 10 mils, Badgingarra 5, Binu in Canterbury 7, Chapman Valley 18, Coolangatta Alert Station 5, Eridu 21 over 2 days, Geraldton 13, Howathara 11, Durian Bay 8, Lancelin Defence 13, Nabawar 11, New Norcia 9, North Island on the Abrolhos had 10, Tabletop 5, Tibraden 10, Wundi 18 and Una 5. In the lower west region, Anketell 10, Bickley 8, Bindoon 7, Bungendore 6, Gidgeganup and Gingin West both had 5, Glen Eagle 7, Jandakot 13, Jarrodale 10, Carnot 12, Lake Chittering 6, Lancelin 12, Lancelin East 14, Mandurah 17, Millenden 8, Mulyabini, Moondar Brook, Mount Solus all had 6 mils, Mouchet 8, Mundaring 5, Pierce at the Raff Base 8, Pinjarra 10, Pinjarra South 5, Serpentine 7, 2J East and Wanneroo had 6, Waroona 5 and Whiteman Park 9. In the southwest region, Beadle up 15, Brunswick Junction 5, Busselton 7, Cape Lewin 5, Cape Naturalist 11, Carlotta 13, Chapman Hill 5, Chapman Hill Road had 7, Quarrum up 14, Doyle Road 6, Four Acres 19, Harvey 10, Jindong 10, Carriedale 5, Logue Brook 8, Manjimup had 9, Margaret River 8, McAlinden 5, Millianup 18, Mount William 7, Mile up 10, Nanup 7. Northcliffe had 7 as well, Pemberton 14, Quinnon up 6, Rosabrook 10, Shannon 6, Somme Creek 7, Vass 5, Warner Glen the same, Williabra up 19, Wychcliffe 10 and Yanmar 13. Not as many to get through in the southern coastal region. Albany 10 and at the Albany Airport 15. Barrett Meadows 20. Shane Beach 9. Denbarker 8. Denmark 15. Many Peaks 5. Mount Barker 7. Stirlings North 6 and Stirlings South 7. The Duke 8 and White Gums had 6. In the central wheat belt even less. Condit with 5 and Nungarring with 6. And in the Great Southern even less. Franklin had 17, and that's it.
Richard, thank you for going through those figures. ABC WA, this is the Country Hour, 20 to 1. Before the news at 1, off to Katanning, Tracy Kilner going through the yarding and the prices at the sheep market for you this afternoon. The horticulture industry has rolled out a new national training and certification initiative. Now, this is all about cracking down on poor and illegal working conditions in the country's fruit and vegetable sector. The industry-led initiative is called Fair Farms. It's been trialled for the last 18 months in Queensland and New South Wales. It comes at the same time the Fair Work Ombudsman has announced compliance in the horticulture industry is a top priority for the year ahead. Program manager Thomas Hurtle says the whole concept of Fair Farms is to give industry a clear direction and consumers the confidence to know they are buying ethical produce.
Horticulture is one of the industries in Australia that has a problem with labour. Fair Farms is the industry taking action on this issue. We want to do it through rolling out a training and certification program. Training will encompass providing the necessary knowledge, tools and support for horticulture employers to enable them to be a compliant employer. And then we will provide a mechanism whereby growers, if they choose to, go through a third-party independent audit, and once they've completed that, become Fair Farms certified. Through the Fair Farms certification, they demonstrate to the market, to workers and to their community that they are committed to fair and employment practices, and we're working towards rewarding those growers for their efforts.
Okay, and now a couple of points on that one. I guess the first is that do you think that people actually don't know that they're not being compliant, or do you think that they're doing it on purpose?
Australia has one of the most complex labour laws in the world, and these migrant workers come on visa categories that are also difficult to navigate, that the average small business has to manoeuvre. And in that environment, more and more reports come out by the Fair Work Ombudsman and other bodies that establish that the level of compliance could be better. And if we have, as you just said, we have probably a number of participants in the industry who are unintentionally non-compliant, who would like and want to do the right thing by their workers, but are just struggling with the complexity of the system. But then we also have what we refer to as rogue operators, which we believe is a small number of person. And one of the goals of Fair Farms is to, over time and in partnership with other stakeholders, work towards driving that sort of behaviour out from our industry.
Mm. Okay, the second one is the certification as well. There is already plenty of auditors out there. There's and regulators, Fair Work, the police, Border Force. How does certification be different to what is already out there regulating and auditing the systems?
I think we need to distinguish between regulation by government and then industry self-regulation. Fair Farms and Rocom is not the government. We're not in the business of enforcing laws. That is the job of the government, that's the job of the police and other agencies. At the moment, as you say, there is ethical auditors out there auditing under different programs, different scopes, different requirements. A very unorganized and complicated system out there. And with Fair Farms, we want to make it easy for the entire industry. We have developed a Fair Farms standard that is contextualized and developed specifically for Australian horticulture in a language that they can understand, and with one set of rules that will work for the entire industry. And we work closely with retailers and wholesalers. We work towards them buying in and supporting our initiative so that everyone can be audited against the one set of rules, the one standard. Woolworths and Aldi have both endorsed Fair Farms as one of the available ethical sourcing programs for their supplier base. And we're working with the other retailers to achieve the same.
Yeah. And so in essence, if the consumer saw a Fair Farm label, what would that indicate to them?
That would indicate to them that the produce has been sourced from a business that takes employment serious and that pays their workers appropriately and that has a zero tolerance towards any form of workers' exploitation. There will be a clear line from the retailer all the way to the grower established that these businesses conform with employment standards in Australia.
In your pilots in the other states, what have been some of the positives and the challenges?
We had a lot of positive feedback by our pilot participants. We've got open feedback from them in terms of how certain things are structured or worded. For example, our program begins with a self-assessment of your employment practice. There's about 200 questions that a participant will answer at the beginning to assess how good they're tracking against the Fair Farm standard. And we had plenty of feedback in regards to how those questions need to be formulated.
Fair Farm's program manager, Thomas Hurtle with Tyne Logan. In Western Australia, there are different rules for small businesses and companies. Small businesses fall under state awards and companies under the federal awards. Now, this is all worked out under the federal system, but Thomas says they are trying to incorporate WA's state laws into it as well, so it is complicated. Fair Farms will officially be launched at the Hort Connect conference later this month in Melbourne. 14-1. Neil Handerside is an Albany-based strawberry grower. He's also president of the WA Strawberry Growers Association. Neil, what do you make of this Fair Farms initiative?
Look, I think it's a great initiative. It's something that the hort industry needs to be on the front foot, and it's been an issue, and it's been in the papers, and we want to make sure that the customer knows that we're doing the absolute best to supply them with the safest produce, and we've done everything we can to do the right thing by everybody that's been along the track in producing that product.
Now, this would be a voluntary system, is my understanding. Do you think it goes far enough?
Probably not. Generally, the issues have been labour hire companies, and so it's been smaller labour hire companies that have set up and supplying to companies and also to state-based, like in WA, small business, and they've said that they've done all these things. They've actually checked all their employees out. They're paying their super, paying their workers' comp, and then growers find out that it's not happening. And so, in Victoria, they have a labour hire authority that's being established, and it's going across more than just horticulture.
What other industries, Neil?
Look, doing a bit of research, it's actually pretty clear that they intend to roll it out over everything. So if you're not directly employing someone and they're like basically a contractor, these contractors have to have a labour hire license to be able to supply these staff to you. So that seems to be like covering, construction. It will cover all areas of basically labour hire and people working on the workplace. So,
yeah, because it's not just restricted to horticulture, quite clearly. So you'd be supportive of that rolling out to other sectors as well. What sort of messages are you getting from the supermarkets about this? Are they, really keen to sort this out once and for all?
Absolutely. They're working as best they can with with the, you know, they can only go so far, and everybody's all got so much time and money that they can spend on every different issue that we have. So certainly they have been upfront about trying to sort this issue out, and certainly the Fair Farms is a great initiative, and it's, I think it needs to go further in a state-based or a federal-based labour hire initiative, so it covers these things, so we're not having little parts of the industry, or certainly not so much the industry, but in the workplace, there are certainly industries that are still not doing it. So it's not just horticulture.
It's much broader than that, isn't it?
It's much broader than that.
How just quickly for us, Neil, how frustrating is it for you in the sector, you know, most people trying to do the right thing, but you've got these bad eggs sort of in there as well?
It's incredibly frustrating. Growers, we hear daily of growers just being so frustrated by seeing or hearing about stories about people doing the wrong thing in different areas, and you basically report it and nothing seems to happen, and so it's like, oh, we don't have the funding to do, you know, audits every day, or, you know, compliance audits all the time, so they can only do so much.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, Neil. Thank you for that. I do appreciate it, just for sharing your thoughts on Fair Farms, and hopefully sounds like it's a step in the right direction anyway.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Neil. Neil Handaside, he is an Albany-based strawberry grower. He's also president of the WA Strawberry Growers Association, talking about that initiative, Fair Farms, just trying to sort out those bad illegal working conditions that you sometimes find in the horticulture sector. 9 minutes to 1 on the Country Hour. Are you like most shoppers and just hate all that excessive plastic packaging? You know, bananas wrapped in plastic, apples in plastic, for example. Well, the major supermarkets are listening, and they really want to make some changes where possible. And that's had a flow-on effect to those in the packaging business. Joe Gillian? I think it is. Gilligan. So Joe Gilligan has been involved in the packaging industry for 20 years and says the push for less plastic is driving a lot of industry innovation.
Certainly it's permeating in a few different areas. So we've got 4 or 5 products now that we're taking to the market that ideally will have a positive impact on the environment. The consumer will appreciate the effort that the growers put into it, but we're also seeing that the grower is more interested in the environment, the market's more interested in the environment, and as a result of that, we're seeing people are starting to think outside the square and are certainly looking for more avenues to differentiate themselves, but also, while doing that, have a positive effect on the environment and the world we live in.
So, for example, we're at a mango conference and we've got some mango trays here. Now, for years, the bottom of a mango tray has been plastic with cups in it to hold the fruit in place. What we're looking at here is looking flat. It's looking different. What is it?
That's what we're calling the paper bubble wrap, and we're very excited by it. It is effectively a way of replacing plastic in the supply chain. We have a paper plix insert as well, which is certainly the first step. The cup placement allows a grower to position his fruit, and this next evolution removes that cup, which will remove redundancy in stock in the supply chain. But certainly it's going to take some time for the grower and potentially the backpacker to pack the tray of fruit. So we're very excited by the paper insert, and particularly the bubble wrap or the bubble paper insert. Yeah. But yeah, we think that one's probably a couple of years away from full market acceptance. So in the meantime, we'll continue with the paper offer, which is gaining momentum in the marketplace very, very quickly, which is great.
Using paper instead of plastic, does it cost more?
There is a small impost on the grower at the moment, but certainly it's in its infancy. And anything to do with our industry, it's all around volume. So our intention is to get that volume up, which helps you reduce the overall price in any manufacturing game. The more you run, the more you make, the cheaper it gets. And that's our intention moving forward.
Plastic has played an important role when it comes to the shelf life of fresh produce. Paper can do the same job, can it?
I don't think we'll ever replace plastic. And certainly different fruit types have different transfers of CO2 or of oxygen and have different requirements in the supply chain. So not sure you'll ever really get rid of plastic completely, and certainly plastic's taking steps to look at what they can do to reduce the level of plastic used. But, yeah, you know, ideally, if we can replace plastic in the supply chain, that's good for our business. But, yeah, we've rolled out paper punnets. Yeah, they've still got an overwrap bag, but that overwrap bag's combustible, recyclable, less plastic than what you'd see in a clamshell. For a punnet, for instance.
And are these paper stickers that we're looking at?
Yes, that's right. The label itself is actually a paper label. You know, we've all eaten an apple and ended up with a bit of plastic in our mouth. So ultimately, if we can get that to a paper-based label, which this one is, it's also printable in line. So if there's a barcode change, etc., you can do that while you're running your fruit through the shed. Which means you're not ordering 200,000 labels at the beginning of the season and then there's a change and they sit in the back corner. So not only is it paper-based, but it also hopefully will reduce waste in the supply chain moving forward as well. And there are other positive benefits to both the paper label. Because it's paper, you can use a citrus watch instead of trying to scrape it off your grater if you're a grower. And certainly with the paper insert, that actually soaks up mango sap, so you're not getting as much burn on the fruit. So while we've rolled it out with, you know, the recyclability banner in mind, we've actually found it provides other benefits throughout the supply chain as well, and particularly for the grower, which is, you know, really, really good.
How much competition is in this space right now in terms of packaging companies?
Look, there's a lot of competition in packaging. I think some of the products that we're taking out to the market probably are at the forefront, which is great. But, you know, typically if you have a large uptake, it's not long before someone catches up.
Joe Gilligan, a veteran of the packaging industry in Australia, catching up with Matt Brand, takes the time to 4 minutes to 1.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, will he stay or will he go? John Setka speaks about his future within the labour movement. Flying cars, a trial of aerial taxis, could turn what sounds like science fiction into a reality for some commuters in Melbourne. And the credit crunch. Each week, we're unwittingly eating and drinking enough plastic to make a credit card.
This is absolutely a wake-up call. To think that plastic is swimming around in our bodies and in our kids' bodies is yet another reason to get serious about tackling this problem.
More than the headlines. The World Today.
And it's not far away. 3 minutes to 1, 3 minutes away from the news at 1 o'clock, followed by The World Today. Just enough time to squeeze in the markets for you. And there was a huge sheep sale at Katanning this morning. Total number sold, 28,887. That's about double the size of last week's yarding. Tracy Kilner's been there keeping an eye on things for you. Tracy, the last few weeks we've seen state records get broken at Katanning for sheep and lamb prices. And I hear the prices were good again today. Did any records get broken?
No, Belinda, prices were great, but no records broken. Lamb prices continued to gain with strong competition from local buyers. A pen of extra heavy lambs sold for a top of $262, while mutton gained with the heavy ewes selling to a top of $177 a head. Light lambs under 12 kilos carcass weight remained firm, selling from $42 to $80. Lambs under 16 kilos carcass weight gained on demand, selling from $75 to $149. Air freight weights under 18 kilos sold from $110 to $181. Trade weight lambs gained $20, making from $120 to $217. Heavy lambs sold from $189 to $220, and the extra heavy lambs sold to $262. The young ewes made from $20 for very small frame lightweights up to $150 for the quality ewes to average $111 a head. The light store boning ewes down to 14 kilos made from $50 to $102 a head. Medium weight ewes in the 18 to 23 carcass weight regained on last week to finish $6 up, making from $80 to $138 a head, including skins. Good quality heavy mutton over 24 kilos carcass weight was up $5, selling from $110 to $177 a head. The weather sold a strong demand, with the processors paying from $65 to $182 depending on weight. Restockers paid $56 to $120 for the lighter weight store weathers offered. Mature rams sold for $20 to $130 to processors to average $63 a head, while the ram lambs made from $38 for lightweights under 14 kilos carcass weight, up to 224 for heavyweights, to average $138 a head. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. Tracy reporting on that really big market at Katanning today, a total yarding of 28,887, about double last week's yarding. Tomorrow, off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market, just to wrap up the livestock markets for this week. Earlier in the hour, we were talking about how Australia's winter crop forecast is set to jump 20% this season, and that's following the drought-ravaged season from last year on the East Coast anyway. So up 20% on last year, and here in WA, it's going to be down a little bit, the wheat crop, that is, on last year's bumper harvest due to the late rain. Check it out on the ABC Rural website. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.